Nearly a quarter of Massachusetts is now in an extreme drought, but many towns in the Commonwealth have not put any kind of water restrictions in place. WBUR's Shannon Dooling has this report on drought divisions along town lines.
That's the sound of a sprinkler system dousing a lush green lawn in Tewksbury. Marie Robinson and her husband Bill have lived in the house on Whipple Road for 50 years.
I hate to tell you how many people have stopped to tell us how nice our grass looks.
Here in Tewksbury, residents can still irrigate their lawn, water their flowers, and even fill up a kiddie pool if they like. But less than half a mile away, just over the line into Billerica, it's a different story.
I was going to take you out here and show you my garden.
Walking across nearly an acre of scorched grass, Tim Hind says he's lived in his family's big farmhouse on this property since 1950. He can't recall ever seeing the land this parched.
I haven't gotten any peppers or eggplants, very few tomatoes. I intended to grow more than this, but just didn't happen.
Under Billerica's water ban, Hind can water his vegetables by hand only. The same goes for anyone keeping livestock. But that's it. Any other outside water use in Billerica is prohibited. So why can Hind's neighbors, three houses down in Tewksbury, continue watering their perennials? It comes down to water sources and state permits.
Unfortunately, we have more permits than we have time to review and update them in a timely manner.
Dwayne Lavangi heads up the state's water management program. Those permits he refers to are required by any entity, be it a town or a golf course, that uses over 100,000 gallons of water a day. The permits have built-in triggers indicating when to start curbing water use. For example, some restrictions are triggered when stream flow drops below a certain level. Problem is, not all permits are up to date.
They are 20-year permits, and we're updating them as quickly as we can, but not every permit holder currently has the requirements. At this point, I'm guessing about 60% of our permits have a requirement telling them that they should be implementing restrictions right now.
And that includes Billerica. The town's permit was updated in 2010 and allows it to pull water directly from the Concord River, which has been hit especially hard during this dry season. Just next door in Tewksbury, however, the town pulls its water from the Merrimack River. Tewksbury's permit is not scheduled for a review for at least another 2 years. In the meantime, Lavangi says plenty of communities this summer are enacting self-imposed rules, and those all add up to the highest number of statewide water use restrictions he's ever seen.
We have about 110 permits that require it now, and we have 170 systems doing restrictions. So, you know, people are doing it without us telling them they have to. So it is far more significant than we've seen in the past.
Standing on the banks of the slow-moving Concord River, Abdul Al-Khatib, head of Billerica's DPW, points to a water stain on a nearby cement slab. The mark indicates the river's normal height.
You could see how low it is right now. You probably have about an average of 3 feet drop from a normal level.
And not only is the water low, but it's also nearly stagnant, which presents another set of problems when it comes to treatment. Al-Khatib says higher levels of manganese and iron in the still water make for a more complicated process, and the town is now treating the water as though it were from a lake instead of a river.
It makes you think about and start to plan, what if there's not much rain in the next month or two, what do you do?
Despite the town-by-town variations, officials at the state level are asking all residents to consider conserving water. Dan Seeger is Assistant Secretary at the state's Office of Energy and Environment.
I think when it comes to this level of lack of precipitation around the state, it's time for everybody to sort of do their part and cut down on their water use at a personal level, you know, regardless of what the restrictions that are within a certain, you know, town's permit versus a neighboring town.
When it comes to the drought, the town line between Billerica and Tewksbury may not be so stark for much longer. Tewksbury officials say they're considering a voluntary ban. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shannon Dooling.
The unpredictability of New England weather is often a punchline, but it's also a major challenge to the use of renewable energy. What happens is that sometimes extra renewable energy gets dumped or a wind plant is told to power down. Vermont Public Radio's Kathleen Masterson reports on how an appliance in your basement, the water heater, might be used for energy storage.
Okay, first to understand just how dramatically renewable energy is changing the grid, here's how the grid has worked for the past 100 years. It was sort of like the world of television in the 1950s when there were only a handful of channels.
Tonight, from the Ed Sullivan Theater on Broadway.
Back then, all the programming was coming top-down from a few broadcasters. Well, that's how the electric grid has worked. Grid operators scheduled when to turn on several large power plants to send energy down wires into homes. But now the grid looks more like the internet. Use is unpredictable, sporadic, with big spikes, and anyone, seriously, almost anyone, can upload their own content.
Oh my gosh, it is a double rainbow. I cannot believe it.
And the grid's turning into that. Homeowners can put up solar panels and then send that energy back onto the grid from all over. And it just wasn't built for that. For an example, let's go someplace sunnier than New England, a place where there were all kinds of financial incentives for renewable energy.
So solar panels popped up all over Hawaii. And that idea of power flowing the wrong way, that happened. And it caused fuses to break and blackouts to happen in Hawaii. The system was just stressed very, very quickly.
That's Masal Masalki, an electrical engineer at the University of Vermont. And he says it's not just the backwards flow that's challenging, but wind and solar are sporadic and unpredictable. They can't just be turned on and off whenever we need power. But his startup is trying to flip the paradigm. Here's Almasalki's colleague and co-founder, Paul Hines.
The big idea is that when there's energy available, you should use it. And when there's not energy available, you should not use it. Should wait until a better time. And so that's the big idea that we're trying to solve.
On its face, it's a simple concept. Almasalki, Hines, and two other co-workers are developing software that would allow common home appliances to effectively store these sporadic bursts of energy that come from wind and solar. But all without the homeowner noticing any difference. Everything would still work when you flip on the switch. They're starting by programming that big tank in your basement, the ubiquitous water heater.
Basically, kind of using this as a virtual battery. So it's like taking all these water heaters and turning them into batteries that can store the electricity, store surplus electricity from the grid.
Right now, water heaters turn on and off at pre-programmed times to stay warm. And, of course, it turns on after you take a shower to heat back up the tank. But what if your home devices were smart? What if your water heater could respond to a signal from the grid and turn on just to absorb some extra energy because all of a sudden it got sunny and solar power surged? Then, later in the day, during peak electricity use time, it wouldn't need to turn on. It would still be hot.
We're basically designing a new system that would be much more flexible than the current approach, whereas instead your water heater is in charge of its own heating. It's just checking with the grid to see whether it's a good time to run or not.
You might be thinking, okay, big whoop, a smart grid could change when my water heater turns on. Who cares? The thing is, when your water heater is heating up, it typically uses 3 times as much energy as your whole house. That's a lot. What if we could ensure that it mostly ran during times with high solar energy or wind? Andrew Giroux is an engineer with the startup, and he's working on just that. Here in their makeshift lab, a small windowless basement office, he's currently programming a much tinier version of your home water heater.
So right here we've got a shelf, 8-foot-long shelf, with all these fluorescent green electric tea kettles all powered off of a single outlet.
Giroux is rigging up tea kettles to test the complex software algorithms where your water heater can request energy from the grid, and the grid can tell your water heater, use this energy now.
If you plug one tea kettle into your outlet, you're good. If you plug 2 tea kettles in, you will trip the breaker. And we're working to make it so that all 10 can get the electricity that they need without tripping the breaker.
And it's getting hot and steamy in this tiny room, which means it's working. For the most part, there are still some bugs to be worked out. The University of Vermont professors received a competitive grant from the Department of Energy to study all this. And in a year or so, they're hoping to be ready to work with the utility Green Mountain Power to actually retrofit some water heaters in people's homes and test the software in the real world. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Kathleen Masterson.
As college students settle back into their dorms and classes, a prominent Harvard professor is posing a provocative question. Given that many students are not active enough for their health, should the university impose a phys ed requirement? WBUR's Carrie Goldberg explores that question in this report.
Professor Daniel Lieberman studies how the human body evolved. He's best known for his starring role in the book Born to Run, about how well-suited we are for endurance running. But he also says we're hardwired to avoid exercise.
It's completely normal and natural to avoid unnecessary physical activity. I mean, that's an adaptation.
Trouble is, it was an adaptation to an environment of scarce food that forced humans to hunt and gather for miles, not to an environment of, say, university dining hall buffets. So Lieberman is proposing a campus discussion on whether Harvard should revive its phys ed requirement from before the Vietnam War era. He says he knows he may be starting a firestorm, that students might see a requirement as coercive. But, he argues, the university requires students to do all sorts of things for their own good. Think, study, take tests.
And so the question that we need to ask ourselves is, should we treat the body any differently than the mind? And I would argue that, you know, we're here for the student as a whole. And furthermore, there's, I think, a false division between the mind and the body. And the two are intrinsically related, and we shouldn't pretend otherwise.
If Harvard does bring back the phys ed requirement, that may help turn a tide that's long been running in the other direction, says Professor Brad Cardinal of Oregon State University. He published a study in 2013 that found a very different picture of physical education than back in the 1920s, when almost all American universities had phys ed requirements.
We found that right now we're at a all-time low for the physical education requirement, with just under 40% of institutions across the country offering a physical education requirement to graduate with a university or college degree.
Today, many colleges and universities have some of the most palatial gyms around, so administrators may feel their students' needs are met. But chances are they're not. Cardinal says less than half of American university students get as much physical activity as the basic national guidelines say they should. Surveys cited in Harvard Magazine find about one quarter of students at Harvard are not really active at all. On the brick sidewalk outside her Harvard dorm, sophomore Molly Levin says, yes, it's hard for some students to get enough exercise. The trouble is finding time and energy in a demanding academic environment.
It's like the easiest thing to push off because you're like, oh, I'll just exercise tomorrow. And when you're already exhausted, then the last thing you want to do is use more energy up.
Personally, she would support a phys ed requirement, but
I also know that there'd be a lot of backlash. It'd be very controversial. So I don't know if it would ever go through. But I personally think it's a great idea. But like, I just came from the gym.
So what might a Harvard phys ed requirement look like? Could you just submit your Fitbit or your Pokemon Go data? Daniel Lieberman says that's all open to discussion. He favors the honor system and that any form of physical activity could count, from intramural sports to climbing stairs. His main point?
We can signal the university's desire to help encourage physical activity and, you know, find ways to prescribe it, nudge, push, maybe shove students in some way that's mutually acceptable. Because obviously, we're not going to do this unless the students buy in as well.
Lieberman says committee discussion of the idea of a phys ed requirement has begun. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Carrie Goldberg.